Welcome to Songcraft. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. You're listening to Running, written and recorded by our guest on this episode of Songcraft, Nora Jones. Nora Jones catapulted onto the music scene at the age of 22 with the release of her now classic debut album, Come Away With Me. She took home 5 Grammy Awards in 2003 alone, including Best New Artist, Record of the Year, and Album of the Year, while Come Away With Me went on to be certified 12 times platinum. The follow-up album, Feels Like Home, became another international chart topper, establishing Nora as a consistent, genre-bending musical force. In total, she has released 9 solo studio albums for the legendary Blue Note Records, multiple projects with side bands such as The Little Willies, El Madmo, and Puss in Boots, collaborative albums with Danger Mouse, Willie Nelson, and Billy Joe Armstrong, and duets or guest appearances with a diverse list of artists that includes Ray Charles, Dolly Parton, Outkast, Ryan Adams, Foo Fighters, Talib Kweli, Jerry Lee Lewis, Herbie Hancock, Tony Bennett, Keith Richards, Mavis Staples, Emmylou Harris, Logic, and Wilco. Over the course of her career, Nora has been nominated for 19 Grammy Awards, winning 9 of them, and she has sold more than 50 million records worldwide. Her latest album, Visions, was produced by Leon Michaels and was just released on March 8th.
Part 1.
Paul, I got 3 words for you.
Let's eat now.
I like those words. and that's usually our guiding principle.
Yeah.
But today the 3 words are Nora frickin' Jones.
Oh, dude.
Right?
Yeah. You said something there. amazing interview.
Yeah. Just how cool. And, you know, I view Nora Jones the same way that I view someone like Ray Charles or Willie Nelson. They defy genre.
Yeah.
They are competent in all genres. It's almost just like an amalgam of all American music, but from someone who is still an unmistakable stylist. I hold her in exceptionally high regard.
Yeah. How can she be such a great creator and such a great interpreter at the same time?
Right.
You know, we at our wedding, we danced to her version of Love Me Tender.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's a sacred song.
Right.
That she interpreted. But then she writes these songs.
Yep.
That have their own resonance and their own, you know, cultural impact. She's able to do pretty much anything she wants.
Right.
She can do jazz. She can do country. She can do Americana. She can do pop. I mean, I don't think
she's been on hip hop records.
I mean, yeah, there's really nothing that Nora can't do. And apparently have an amazing interview and conversation with us can be added to the list because she outdid herself.
Yeah. And I'm sure she was intimidated, you know, because it was us, right?
You can even talk to Scott and Paul.
Of all of her accomplishments. But you asked her a question about one of her songs in the interview where you talked about her patience as a songwriter and artist. And I think that might kind of be the secret to Nora Jones's music is the patience of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not about these rapid fire lyrics. Sometimes a song will sort of just like take its time getting to the time the lyrics even show up. These kind of like loping, you know, interesting intros that they're slow builds, you know,
right.
And the songs are patient. The productions are patient. She doesn't feel like she's trying to lure you into smacking you with a hook.
right.
She's drawing you into an experience with the songs. And there is a real patience to it. And it's cool to see artists in a time like this, which is so kind of fast paced and our attention spans are being bombarded at every turn.
Right.
And the way we're consuming music on these social media platforms like TikTok, we're biting off 15-second snippets.
That's right.
And to see someone like Nora, who's still holding on to, you know, to taking a song and living in it and sitting it, letting the song soak over you. And that's this new album, man. I just loved sitting in it.
Yeah. There's kind of a Nashville saying that I used to hear, don't bore us, get to the chorus.
Right, exactly.
And I'm like, I feel like what Nora Jones does flips that on its head. It's more like, I'm not going to bore anyone, but why are we in such a rush?
Right.
Come on in. I've got a nice fire in the fireplace.
Right.
Have a cup of cocoa,
right.
Sit down, pull up a blanket, get comfy. It's just, it's the musical equivalent of inviting someone in.
It's like, don't sweat the chorus. The song is Nora's.
That might be the new, yeah, that might be the new tagline. But I thought about this when I was at the Grammy Awards. Humble brag.
Yeah, there you go.
And one of the best performances that night was Luke Combs and Tracy Chapman singing Fast Car together. Mm. And Tracy Chapman, I mean, that is a song from our generation.
Sure.
Fast Car is a masterwork of a song. Luke Combs is a country artist who had a huge hit with it and basically kept the arrangement, you know, completely intact from the original version. And so Tracy Chapman, who's kind of been out of the public eye for a little while, comes out and sings this song with him. And, you know, if you know the song, it's got that intro. Well, that full intro happens not once, but twice after every verse. And there are four verses before you get to the chorus. So talk about patient. I mean, and I don't even know if you call that a chorus or a hook or whatever it is, but at no point have I ever listened to that song and thought it was boring. Like it's great songwriting. It holds you in the palm of its hand. It engages you.
And just like I was saying too, about songs like that winning in today's climate, that was a number one song.
Yeah.
You know, now.
Yeah.
In 2020, well, it was 2023, correct?
Yeah, right.
But it was just a number one song. And I think maybe we're like missing the point when we think like the public's attention span is shortening or something like that. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. Maybe we're just not delivering them
right
what it is that they want and need.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we all can agree that our ability to pay attention has decreased, but maybe it's because we're not being given the quality of stuff sometimes that we need in order to engage. So see, it's not our fault. It's everybody. It's the songwriter's fault.
You know, right? You mentioned the Grammys, and the Grammys had another moment where I think patience was rewarded, and that was the Joni Mitchell segment.
Yeah.
When everyone kind of sat around and played Both Sides Now, because that's a song, if you want to really feel the impact of Both Sides Now, you got to get to the verse about, I've looked at clouds from both sides now, mm-hmm. and then I've looked at love from both sides now, and then it concludes with, I've looked at life from both sides now. And there's a sort of deepening impact that the song takes as you go along, if you're patient enough to let it get there.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this sort of Joni resurgence has been very much kind of organized and cheerlead by Brandi Carlile. And, you know, my Brandi Carlile fandom is well
documented, yeah.
Well established. Brandi Carlile produced this EP by Tish Melton, who we're going to get to hear from after our conversation with Nora. And Tish is a 18-year-old now, but 17-year-old when she made this EP. And just very cool to kind of talk with her. And it's almost like this continuum, right? You have Brandi, who is clearly a disciple of Joni Mitchell, but then also mentoring Tish. Yeah. And Tish is probably teaching Brandi some things about her generation. Like, it's just cool to see this kind of intergenerational, you know, songwriter, musician thing happening. And Tish is the daughter of Glennon Doyle, who is an author and has a podcast. I think it's called We Can Do Hard Things. Yeah. It's popular.
I think Tish wrote the theme song.
Yeah.
To the podcast.
With Brandi Carlile, apparently. I think your wife's an avid listener of that podcast.
Yeah, she's a fan.
Not of ours.
Not of ours, but she likes Glennon's.
Yeah.
So awesome. Thanks, babe.
So maybe maybe if you know, Glennon mentions our podcast,
that would help.
Then your wife would know what we're up to.
That would help.
Which would be...
I don't need my wife knowing what I'm up to. That's slow your roll.
That's enough. Yeah. That's enough. No, but it's just fun to talk to somebody like Nora, who we've been listening to for, you know, close to 25 years now. And somebody like Tish, who's just kind of starting on that journey and just thinking about the connections of what good songwriting means from generation to generation. And I think a lot of it is about this patience thing.
Yeah. And how patient were you at 17, 18?
Not so much.
How patient are you now?
Less.
I'm actually not terribly patient either. I want to hear this interview.
Yeah, and I think we should just get to it and let the people listen to it. And then when you're done with this one, go back a couple episodes, listen to our conversation with Duff McKagan. He was a co-writer on a song called Patience. You see what I did there?
I see what you did there.
Part two.
Nora, welcome to Songcraft.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's great to speak with you. I just finished listening to your new album, Visions. And it reminded me that you are one of the very few artists in this world who manages to completely transcend genre. And I think of people like Willie Nelson, Ray Charles, Elvis Costello, people who are as jazz as they are country, as they are pop. And all of you guys embrace a wide variety of music, but still remain unique stylists. And what's interesting about that to me is that all of you are avid song interpreters, as well as being songwriters. And I think there's something to that. I think there's something to studying and interpreting the songs of so many other people that shapes you as a songwriter and influences you as a songwriter. So I'd be curious just to get your thoughts. In what ways do you think that kind of enthusiastically exploring a lot of different music has shaped you as a writer yourself when you're writing your own songs?
I think coming from a background of interpreting songs definitely has shaped a lot of things for me as a musician too, but especially as a songwriter. I came to songwriting kind of late. I was 20 when I wrote Come Away With Me. And I had only written one song in high school before that. And I hated it. So I never, I shut the book on that for a minute, you know, I was embarrassed by it. And it took a long time to get around that and learn that it's okay to be embarrassed by things because you don't have to show them to everybody if you don't like it in the end.
Right.
But I started out singing jazz, but I always loved all kinds of music. I grew up listening to Willie Nelson and Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles. I think just imitating all kinds of singers, Joni Mitchell, you know, it's sort of just, I don't know. I guess I was always just me. Also, I learned in college, I think, or high school to just sort of try to sing. There was a long time when I imitated other singers, but I tried to just sing as myself once I got to college. And I remember singing a jazz standard for a friend once in college. And he said, "Wow, you really got that Texas twang." And I was like, "Really? I didn't even think that. I certainly wasn't trying to. I was singing a Billie Holiday song, you know?" So I think just bringing yourself into whatever you're doing kind of helps just do whatever and not have a lot of borders on it.
Yeah.
You know, I saw that the song Running, which is kind of the first single that you've released from the record, that was a song that kind of jolted you awake when you were half asleep. That's even kind of been a hallmark of a lot of the songs in this record, which I think is where the title maybe kind of came from, Visions. But, you know, you have to really know yourself to know when are the times that you're going to be sort of creatively fertile. And, you know, one of those, for me, I remember when I was younger, always thinking if an idea came and I was kind of half asleep, well, I'll remember that in the morning. I'll get to that in the morning. It never, ever happens. and so, you know, after all this time, are you becoming very familiar with yourself and your own environment and the things that inspire you and the moments that are special moments for you in terms of being a creator?
Yeah, I think the ideal is to catch it when it happens. So, you know, the smartphones certainly help that, get your little voice memos. I had a friend, a songwriter friend, Richard Julian, when I first moved to New York City. He was a big sort of mentor of mine and close friend. He used to call his home voice machine with song ideas all the time.
Yep.
You know, I used to carry around a little voice recorder that would always run out of batteries, but the smartphones and the voice memos are super helpful for all of that. I think it's important to, you're never going to remember that idea in the middle of the night.
Never. Ever.
You might not even remember that you had it.
And it's always the best idea you ever had.
It's like that Tenacious D song, the greatest song in the world. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Then you have to write the tribute because you can't remember it.
That's so funny. Well, the song Visions is an interesting production approach, because you essentially have just you playing an electric guitar. It could not be more stripped down. And then all of a sudden here come these kind of mariachi sounding horns out of nowhere, which is just surprising, but also perfect.
I don't like surprises, but looking in your eyes is coming at me wise, like a freight train. And I'm afraid your rain is gonna fall and wash me.
Other artists might be tempted to start putting too much, start adding too many things, and the song is so beautiful in its simplicity, both as a song and as a record. And I'm curious for you, when you, say, have one of these moments where you're drifting off to sleep and you start thinking of a song, do you often kind of envision the sound? Like, in other words, are you kind of envisioning the production in your mind as you're writing a song, or do you just kind of more think of the melody and the chord structure, and then in the studio some of those production things start coming together?
I always have a sort of general color palette that I'm thinking of, and sometimes it's very specific. On a few of these songs it was very specific. That song in particular, I knew it was going to just be stripped back, and I had this thought of these mariachi horns like way off in the distance. And then working with Leon Michaels, he always has me add harmonies to everything very quickly. We added all the harmonies to this record before we even added bass to some of the songs, because we recorded most of them just he and I on drums. He played drums and I played either piano or guitar. And then I would do the vocals and I would do all these harmony vocals. And by the time we got done with that, there really wasn't room for anything else, because the emotion was already in the vocals and the harmonies kind of filled all the spaces.
Yeah.
But I'm not very tempted to add more stuff. I've always been a little bit of a minimalist in that way. I've also realized that my voice shines when it's set up right. You know, if it's covered up by a lot of stuff, my voice isn't really maybe going to cut through, you know?
Yeah.
Some voices might better with that kind of a production, but mine is better with a lot of space around it. And I try to keep it that way.
Yeah.
Since you're mentioning background vocals, I was really struck on the song Paradise. And I was going to ask you if that's you doing your own BGVs, because it's what it sounds like. But it's interesting because you don't really take a stack approach when you do harmonies. I mean, there are different tonalities to each part, even different vibrato approaches, which sort of makes it feel a little bit more like a group than this stack thing. But it's something that I kind of hear, you know, something like Marvin Gaye would do, where it's almost like sometimes two leads that are occupying different intervals. Joni Mitchell, Lauryn Hill. I mean, what is your process and approach? Because to me, if I was layering vocals, it would be so easy to kind of slip into stacking them, you know? That where you
stacking,
feel like you're doubling,
what,
you know?
What do you mean by stacking?
I mean, like getting doing a ton of where, them? Like the Michael Jackson thing, where they're so tightly, the vibratos are just lockstep with each other. And it sounds like one person doing a million voices, rather than the kind of group approach. It almost feels like the Supremes or something at times, the way you do it.
Oh, thanks. I really think I just do it and I don't think about it that much.
I watch you fall. I try to stop.
Leon always asks me to double the background vocals, which I don't always think cuts through as well emotionally. And it can sound like a bunch of random people sometimes. sometimes it worked really well on this record, and sometimes, like on Paradise, actually, I think the background vocal is doubled, but it's not like quadrupled. You know what I mean? It's still kind of intimate sounding. And I remember when we were mixing specifically, our mixing engineer, Jens Younger, he, you know, a couple of the first passes had the background vocals tucked in a really nice way, totally normal approach, sounded good, but like, I really wanted to hear them loud. I don't know why. They just, I missed them because I'm so used to them. I almost do like them as like almost even with the vocals.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, in singing with a lot of different people, especially my good friend Sasha Dobson, who I'm in a band with, Puss in Boots, we have a really good blend with each other. And so I feel like it works best when it's kind of even, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're just adjusting to each other. So I just do that with myself too when I'm doing background vocals. I just adjust as best as I can.
Hmm. I think there's a question here about collaboration, because you worked on this new record with Leon Michaels, and the two of you wrote a lot of the songs together. And this is something that, you know, we've seen kind of throughout your career. Your 2012 album, Little Broken Hearts, was produced by Danger Mouse, and your previous record, Pick Me Up Off the Floor, was produced by you and Jeff Tweedy. So you kind of have these moments where you kind of go into the studio with a partner, and it's this, I'm sure, very intense time of creativity. I'm curious for you, what it is about working with like one person in a very intense way on one project, and then on another project working with a different person in a very intense way. What does that do for you creatively? How does that sort of influence your process as a songwriter and artist?
It's inspiring. I think also the different sonic landscapes that Leon has, because he also engineered a lot of the record and it was done in his studio with his whole setup, you know. So sonically, it sounds very much different than anything I've done before, because he has his own vibe. He's an incredible musician and producer, especially sonically. Like, just all the sounds he gets are always cool. That's inspiring. Also, just finding somebody you're comfortable with in that way is inspiring. Before the Danger Mouse record, I had written with a few friends, written songs, but I always went into the studio with songs that were finished and trying to come up with a good recording of them. When I made the Danger Mouse record, Brian said he'd rather go in with nothing and just see what we can come up with in the studio. I had never worked like that before. And that was a treat. And I loved it. And I was a little like timid at first, but because we became friends so quickly, and we were already friends actually at that point, I felt comfortable, you know. You throw out a bad idea, that's fine. It doesn't have to be on the record, you know.
Yeah.
I think the whole key is you have to be comfortable with someone. Same thing when I went in with Jeff Tweedy. I have known him for 20 years, but we had never worked together in this way. And he's such an incredible songwriter. I definitely felt a little less than, but at the same time, I bring my own thing to it.
Sure.
He has his own thing. We're both musicians in our own right. You know, we both do different things. I quickly felt very comfortable and it was just so fun. And so that's how I feel with Leon, is that sense of like ease and comfort, friendship. We laughed a lot. We just had so much fun playing music, and then the lyrics sort of flowed fairly quickly. Some songs were quicker than others. A few took a little more going back and forth on my notes section, you know. But mostly it's just like a really wonderful, easy process of exchanging just musical energy and ideas.
So I've read that you kind of grew up in Texas and started initially singing in church and singing in school. And, you know, there's probably a book to be written about artists who started out singing in church. And I think that it's a place where you're given a platform and given an opportunity to be in front of a lot of people that hopefully are not going to throw tomatoes at you. So it's a place where you sort of get to fail in a supportive environment and then get a chance to do it again. And that you know, can strengthen somebody's confidence and their abilities with the raw talent they have. Just curious to get your thoughts on that, about sort of having opportunities when you were young, because your first album blew up when you were in your very early 20s. So it's not like you had all these many, many years to get comfortable in front of an audience. So I'm just curious about your very early years as a kid and those opportunities that you had and what that did for you in terms of just honing kind of who you were in front of a group.
I agree with you. The church choir thing is a really big part of so many musicians. And I think, yeah, I was around 5 when I started singing in church choir, and I had no sense of shyness yet. That didn't come till I was around 9 or 10. And so I projected and I enunciated just like she told us. And I always got the solos because I wasn't shy about it.
Right.
And I felt like I could sing, you know. I definitely felt confident. I didn't think about it that much, but I think I felt confident enough. And then, I don't think we went to church much after 5th grade or something. And then I was in school choirs throughout, and I took piano lessons, and, you know, it all kind of came together from there. But some of my friends from high school, that were some of the best musicians I knew, also grew up, playing in church, playing piano, drums, incredible musicians. It's an incredible way to just be creative in a community. Yeah. Without a lot of judgment and learn. I tried to get my own kids to join a choir, but there's no kids choirs, or there's very few kids choirs around. So I started going to churches to see if we could find a church to join with a children's choir, for that reason. But, it's an interesting thing.
When you started to get involved, and, you know, you majored in jazz piano in college, and, you know, the jazz community is another one you can find yourself in and find your people that you work well with and things like that. But I imagine that it can also be a daunting community to enter, to try to sort of prove yourself and to prove that you belong. And so how did you kind of, you know, you talk about finding embarrassment and shyness around the age of 9 or 10, but then somewhere around the age of 19 or 20, you probably had to get rid of that. So talk to me a little bit about entering that community and trying to find your footing as a jazz musician.
Well, I actually went to a performing arts high school in Dallas. So that kind of was a big setup for college. And I was technically a jazz piano major in high school, but it was a little more loose. We also had a synthesis ensemble where we learned to play keyboards and stuff. And we were encouraged to write songs, which is where I wrote my first song that I was super embarrassed by afterward. But it was a really cool environment, and it wasn't super strict in terms of jazz lane being very set. And then when I went to college, it was a little more specific. And I think I was a little daunted because I felt like, you know, I was a decent piano player, but I never had a lot of chops. I never could play really fast. I still can't. But I think I have a cool thing, and that's fine now. But at the time, you know, I think a lot of the kids at school played real fast, and, you know, there was all these big bands you could be in starting at the 1 o'clock and the 2 o'clock and the 3 o'clock and the 4 o'clock. It's like, which o'clock did you get into, you know? but it was fun, and everybody was pretty nice. Also, you know, there weren't a ton of women in the program. So we all kind of stuck together, and the guys were nice enough to us. It was this nice environment, but it definitely was specific, you know? But I also sang on the side, and I ended up joining a couple bands singing. And so I think I quickly learned that for me as a musician, I wasn't going to fit into any specific lane that was a college course. It was more, I sing and I play, and if I can kind of marry these things together, it's sort of my own thing. And I started playing at a restaurant in Dallas called Popolo's. It was an Italian restaurant. I got this gig. It was a great gig because it paid $100 a night, which was a lot of money for me. And they fed me and I got tips. it was a great gig. And because they let me sing, even though the gig wasn't supposed to be singing, I said, well, I'm an okay piano player, but I can also sing. So can I do both? And they said, and then they heard my demo and they said, yeah, okay, you can do both. Maybe like don't sing the whole time though, because it's a restaurant. Okay. So I would sing like every six songs, and it was paid practice.
Yeah.
You know, I started getting more confident, and I would sing maybe every three songs after a few months. And it was literally like, what is it? Rubbing your stomach, yeah, and patting your head, trying to play piano and sing at the same time. It was a little bit of a coordination issue.
Wow.
So I got better and better at it. And that gig was really incredible for me. I had that gig for 2 years, and it was good.
People don't often know how hard it is to play for an audience that's not listening.
Yes. And nobody listens, yeah. But every once in a while. Well, but it is hard, and it can be soul crushing. But at the time I was so young and so green,
yeah,
and I made so many mistakes on the piano that I was kind of stoked that they weren't listening. It was like paid right. practice. And every few gigs, like the slowly one person would clap after one song, and then the whole restaurant would like look up and start clapping out of like
well, guilt.
It was kind of awkward, but also really sweet. And right. then every once in a while, a few people that would come back and want to sit near me and like it. And then I sort of like won them over, you know? So it was cool.
I love the thought of all these families kind of walking the earth now that have no idea that they saw you from 5 feet away, that they just sat and ate pasta primavera while, you know, yeah, someone that they would, some they, of the probably have your record.
Some of the waiters and the staff at the restaurant, I kept in touch with for a while, and they were all really good to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool to have you on the show, because I have referenced your first album several times, in different interviews, as a hallmark of something that came along at a time that was so needed. And the reason I reference it, there's a million reasons I could, because it's a great record. But one of the things I love about that record is there are moments on it when I can hear the piano bench creak, and I can hear fingers on fretboards, and I can hear all of the things that make it sound like a record made by humans. And in 2022, there weren't a lot of records that sounded like they were made by humans. They were...
In 2002 or...
Sorry, yeah, 2002.
In 2000, especially not 2022.
Especially not, yeah, even worse. But yeah, in 2002, there were not a lot of records that sounded to me like they were made by humans. And that's what I loved about your first record so much, is you could almost visualize the people in the room making this wonderful organic music. And you said something a little earlier. I think what you were saying was that Come Away With Me was kind of the first song you wrote after your 16-year-old efforts. Is that, did I hear that right?
It is. Yeah. I moved to New York to play jazz when I was 20. I dropped out of college and I moved to New York, and I started playing in like restaurants, and I quickly got sick of it because I had already done that in Texas, and I wasn't good enough to play at jazz clubs yet. And again, I didn't quite fit in the jazz club box. A lot of them don't have a lot of singers. And I don't know. I wasn't sure what I was doing. And my friends, Richard, Julian, and Jesse Harris, who I had met already before I moved to New York, they played a lot at the Living Room Songwriter Club. And I would go see them all the time. And it was just so fun. It became a real scene. Maybe it was before I got there already, even. And finally, I did some demo for Jesse where I sang his songs for his, he had a Sony publishing deal. And he's like, that's so cool. Let's do a gig. I said, sure. So he booked a gig at the Living Room. And we did like four of Jesse's songs, a few of my bass player at the time, Lee Alexander songs. And I did like Come Away With Me. Mm-hmm. And I think that I had been inspired to write that song by just going to those clubs and not having a piano in New York City yet. And I had a little crappy guitar that I busted out one night late at night. And I only knew four or five chords on the guitar. And that's all the chords that are on that song.
Wow.
And it's kind of a country song, really. Mm. It's not a jazz song.
Yeah.
Has no seventh chords.
Right.
Come away with me on a bus. Come away where they can't tempt us. with their lies. And I want to walk with you on a cloudy day in fields where the yellow grass grows knee high. So won't you try to come away with me? On a mountain.
Scott and I went to Willie Nelson's 90th birthday celebration at the Hollywood Bowl, which you were at. And one of the things that I was sitting listening to this, you know, when you listen to someone's catalog all together, you start to notice tendencies, you know. And I was noticing, I said to Scott, I said, listen to how early he gets to the title. In so many of these songs, he either opens with it or it's there halfway through the first stanza. You know, he's not a guy that waits for the end of the chorus usually to have a big turn and twist. And I began to notice that about your catalog as well. I mean, Come Away With Me, you know, Sunrise. I mean, the new record, Running, I Just Want to Dance comes in very quick. You come in with that title really soon. And then I started kind of like analyzing your titles a bit. And I thought, man, you really find the beauty in a simple phrase. And instead of making it this linchpin of the song, getting to the title and finding the big reveal, you take a phrase like Come Away With Me, which if I said it on its face, it just sounds like a sentence. But you find the beauty in it, and I'm just curious about your approach to titles. And are titles things that inspire you, or are they things that emerge from the song and declare themselves the title?
I think it's something I don't really think about. I think most songs
I've
for me
it.
Come from... I mean, they kind of, I think they declare themselves the title, yes. But I think most songs come from little snippets or ideas where, like, the good part is the first idea, usually. And the good part is usually the title or the chorus, which usually comes first, you know, and I don't wait for it probably for that reason, just because it starts the whole idea off, I guess, which makes sense.
Hey, Songcraft listeners, quick break from our conversation with Nora Jones to remind you about our friends at Pearl Snap Studios.
And Scott, a lot of our listeners have actually used Pearl Snap before, but I still think they might be the best kept secret in the music business.
Definitely.
All you've got to do is write a great song. Then you don't have to get involved in the recording of it, trying to figure out how to use Pro Tools, you know, any of that stuff. Let Justin and his team of producers at Pearl Snap Studios do that for you. And they can turn your song into a quality recording that can be pitched. It could show up on the radio, who knows, but you're going to be proud of it.
Yeah, no matter what your project, big or small, talk to Justin and his team. Go to pearlsnapstudios.com, tell them that Songcraft sent you, and you'll get a discount on your first recording. It's interesting that you say Come Away With Me is kind of a country song, because you look at some of the cover songs on that first record, and you've got John D. Loudermilk, you know, and you've got Hank Williams, and you have embraced country music from the very earliest parts of your career, and, you know, have duetted with Dolly Parton, have done a ton of duets with Willie Nelson. You know, Puss in Boots is a side project where you explore country elements. You had the Little Willies, which was, you know, country music has been a very, very central part of your career. And, you know, though we're both based in LA, Paul and I are Nashville natives, so country music is part of our DNA as well. And I don't think people necessarily think of, oh, Nora Jones and country music, even though it's so out there and it is so much a part of, you know, who you are as a songwriter and artist. But would love to just hear you talk a bit about what it is about country music and the structure, and the style of country music songwriting that draws you and influences your own writing.
I think I just grew up with it. My mom is from Oklahoma. I grew up going to my grandparents' house in Oklahoma, listening to Hank Williams on their record player, you know? And so my mom had it too in our house. And then I grew up in Texas on top of it. It's just in the water.
Yeah.
I don't even think it's something I think about as a thing. It's just music to me. You know what I mean? Even Ray Charles, you know, my favorite Ray Charles is when he gets real country.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's just something I've always, it's just been part of my growing up. So I always feel, it sounds and it feels like home to me. When I hear Willie Nelson, he sounds like home. Hmm. When I hear Hank Williams, it feels home. When I moved to New York when I was 20, I missed, I think, a piece of home so much. And I got real deep into country music when I moved into New York, not realizing how much I already knew about it, you know?
Yeah.
Because it was just around all the time.
Hmm.
And so that's when I really understood that it was a big part of what I loved, is when I came away from Texas.
Yeah. Speaking of things feeling like home.
I thought that too.
Yeah.
What a segue. You set that up perfectly.
Amazing. The song Sunrise. You know, I've listened to that song a million times, and in preparing for today, I started listening to it with my analytical ears on, and all of a sudden I realized I'm in that hook, and I'm like, I think it's counting to seven in this spot. You know, it wasn't just sitting in fours, and it's something that I hadn't thought about in the way I listened to like a Rush song or something like that when they're doing different counts or time signatures. It slipped right by me, right? But it's something that makes the song feel, I don't know, there's that asymmetry provides a humanity to the song that's similar to the creaks in the bench, I think, that Scott mentioned. And your music doesn't seem to have this intentional symmetry of looping and repeating and color by numbers and things like that. But I found it so interesting that you were able to kind of slip a seven count in there.
As you're saying this, I'm like singing it in my head, counting. I was like, is it in seven? I don't know if it's in seven.
Or is it
but
a bar
it definitely
three?
Has a weird.
Yeah, it
a
drops a bar somewhere.
It
comes back in, you know, yeah, maybe my counting's off. I'm not great with math, and it was later.
No,
night,
there is something weird about it, I think.
But it doesn't feel weird.
Sunrise, sunrise, looks like morning in your. But the clock's held 9:15 full hours. Sunrise, sunrise, couldn't tempt us if it tried. 'Cause the afternoon's already come and gone. And I said, who?
And I'm curious about those choices when you make them. Is that just sort of you bring it in? You're like, this is how I wrote it. I wasn't even thinking about it. It sounds like that's the case.
Yeah, definitely. I never think about time in that way, but I feel like I have written quite a few songs with odd times. And it just feels natural to do it.
Yeah.
It's funny because I play with this incredible drummer, Brian Blade, who has played in all kinds of time signatures. And we were playing some song that was in seven. And we were trying to go over it with the bass player, and he's like, I think it's right here. It's like this weird time. It's like it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, right? And then he looks at Brian and he goes, I don't know, I don't count. And I was like, that's me too. I don't count. It's just I either feel it or I don't.
Right.
So if I ever have to think about it, I usually mess it up.
Wow.
Wow. Well, that feels like home record. In addition to Sunrise, What Am I to You was a very successful single off that record. I understand that's another one that was super early in your songwriting days, right?
Yeah, actually I wrote Come Away With Me and then I wrote What Am I to You all in that same sort of 2 month period.
Wow.
And we actually recorded What Am I to You 3 times for my first record, but we just didn't really grab a version that I loved. It didn't feel like it belonged on the record yet. And then for my second record, we were, and I say we, because me and the band had been touring for like a year and a half. We were all family by that point, you know, a lot of the second record was influenced by listening to like a ton of Dolly Parton. Alison Krauss had an incredible record that year. Gillian Welsh, David Rawlings went on tour with us that year. We were obsessed with all that stuff. And I think we were also obsessed with the band. And watching The Last Waltz on the bus repetitively. So What Am I to You? I felt like we played it live during my whole first record tour. So we played it so much that we almost couldn't get a good version of it. I feel like there's something backwards about that, but it's almost like I love capturing a first moment on tape. of a song. I feel like it's at its most true intention or something, even though I know there's something to be said for rehearsing and working something out. But for me, it doesn't completely work that way. It's
Yeah.
better captured right out of the gate. So because we couldn't have that with that song, and because I had some pull finally, we asked Garth Hudson and Levon Helm to come play on it. And
Wow.
so it was really special that recording had them from the band on it
Wow.
together.
That's amazing. I don't think I realized that. That's very cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a really special day in the
Yeah.
studio.
What am I? Fast as you can be, deep the shade of blue.
You know, I'm curious. You talk about capturing that first moment, and it makes a lot of sense when I listen to the records. And there is this, there's this sort of magic on the head of a pin, breathlessness sometimes that it feels like these performances have. What kind of environment do you set up visually, atmospherically to accommodate that in the studio? Because, you know, I was listening to just even the drumming on the new record. I was like, man, it's like impossibly patient drumming. And I'm envisioning guys fighting traffic to get to the studio, radio's playing, whatever. You come in, you found a spot. Okay, sorry guys, I'm in, you get set up. There's got to be something that brings people from that mindset into now I'm in the space of creating this environment. I mean, are you a candle person? Are you a, do you guys record with the lights down low? I'm curious. You can't possibly just have traffic buzzing by the windows.
I would love for there to be more of a vibe, but I never try to do anything like that. Sometimes I'll be like, the light's too bright, let's turn it off.
Yeah.
Some studios have the vibe for you, you know, they set up that vibe knowing that that's what's good for people. But I'm not really, I mean,
You guys are
you
just
see, there's not
that
much on my walls. I'm really bad at setting up a vibe.
good.
Yeah. I'm
Yeah.
not I kind of live like a college kid sometimes if left to my own devices and I
Yeah.
forget to put pictures on the wall. So I need to do more of that.
Would you like some guitars?
Yeah. Can I have some of your guitars, please?
Yeah, and I think to further that point of what Paul is saying about the drumming on the new record, and I'm not going to take credit for this because Paul said it to me this morning, but he said, the thing that's great about Norah Jones's music is it's patient music. And we live in an impatient world, but your music almost, I think, makes people, it almost forces you to engage and pay attention a little bit. And you know, we've all had our attention spans obliterated by our phones and every other competing thing in this world. But even though you have put out a lot of records that sound different from one another, they, you know, it's not like you're putting out the same sounding record. You're always kind of pushing boundaries and exploring new ground. But I would say the through line is that kind of patience thing. You don't, your records are not overproduced. The songs don't try to throw a lot at you right out of the gate. They sort of invite you in to engage. And I don't know if there's even necessarily a question there, but I think maybe it's just how do you maintain that sort of restraint in a world that is just getting faster and faster all around us?
I guess I don't think of it as restraint. It's just how I do things. I'm not restraining myself. I also, you know, I came up singing jazz, which is not a screamy type of singing.
Right.
It's not the athletic singing you hear on pop radio, which some of it I adore, don't get me wrong, but it's not something I can do. I think my voice has changed over the years, and I've definitely pushed it a lot further in the last four records than I did in the first three, you know, but I don't know. There's just something about the way I like to hear a song I want it to sound, again, it comes down to the emotion of it. You want to really just hear the emotion of the lyric. It can be the most cliche lyric on the planet, but if you strike the right emotion, then it'll connect with people.
Yeah.
I'm not a brilliant songwriter, but I feel like I know how to connect what I'm trying to say and how I'm trying to say it in a way that is emotional and like conveys that emotion in the best way.
Yeah.
And that's just for my own songs, you know? So I think, I don't know. I think that's what it is. It also comes down to not being like a fast player either, you know? I also have always, I've always used drummers who are sensitive on the cymbals and know not to over bash on a cymbal because it competes with sort of my vocal range. And, you know, there's a thing there. The space is the place for me, you know. I want a deep groove, but it doesn't mean it has to be busy, and it doesn't mean it needs a ton of shiny notes.
I remember when your third record, Not Too Late, came out, and you know, a song like Thinking About You sounded like the natural progression of what I knew of Norah Jones, you know, from the first two records. And then a song like Sinkin' Soon, I was like, whoa, this is different. This is a different aesthetic. It's a different production style.
Tiny hole has sprung a leak in this cheap pontoon. Now the hole has started growing weak, and we're gonna be sinking soon.
I think the thing that's interesting about that Not Too Late record is that's the first record where you wrote every song. You weren't bringing in, you know, cover songs or doing songs from your friends or anything like that. This was your artistic statement as both an artist and a songwriter. What was that experience like for you to sort of say, okay, I'm now doing a record where it's just, these are all my songs. I'm not relying on anybody else's stuff. Here's me. This is my personal statement. Was that sort of a shift for you?
Yeah, it actually was a big shift because the first two records were not only not all my songs, but they were huge. And it was also like a very personally weird time for me coming off of those two really big records and very long tours and coming home and having nothing to do and not understanding how to deal with all of it, and just also being kind of sad. I think, you know, relationship stuff and everything, you know, lonely. When you come off of a huge endeavor, like a year long tour, there's a real low that happens as a musician. You have to really find something to do with yourself, or you get kind of depressed. And it doesn't matter if you're successful or not, it's just kind of a weird place to be. And so I started also, I think politically in the world, in the country, a lot was going on then. There was just a lot of feelings happening, you know, my age, all of it kind of combined. And so I was, you know, writing here and there. I was always writing since that first record. It wasn't like it ever stopped. I got more and more, comfortable doing it and trying things, and but I was still shy to show stuff to people. And I think that was the record where I got a little bit, you know, I actually remember hanging out with Bryan Adams, who I really loved his records at the time. We didn't know each other very well, but we had met, and he called me and wanted to know what I was doing. And so I said, I'm just kind of, you know, frustrated. I don't really know how to write. He's like, that's stupid. Yes, you do. Just do it. It was really good advice, honestly.
Yeah.
And I ran into the same advice when I read Jeff Tweedy's book, How to Write One Song. Have you guys read that?
No. Yeah, I've read it.
It's really great. Yeah. It's a great creative handbook, whether you know how to do it or not. And it's a great, it was great advice. And it was the same advice that Ryan gave me at that time, which was just do it. If, you know, it doesn't matter if it's bad, just keep doing it and you'll get better. And also you don't have to show it to anybody. And yeah. I don't know. It was like good confidence booster.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even like he was telling me I was good at it. He was just saying, it doesn't matter if you're good at it, just do it. And I think that's what I needed. And so I ended up making that record. Lee Alexander and I made that record in our home studio. We were together at that time. And we were just sort of, it was just like a very safe place. It was me and him and the band. And it basically at home, you know, we would record in our sweatpants and our jammies.
Right.
So it was really nice. And it's kind of a interesting record. I think there's some really beautiful stuff on it that I love. And then there's some stuff on it that I haven't played since, you know, but I think that's how songwriting is. When you write something young, you either learn from it and you become the song almost, it almost like predates what you're going through. And before you know, you're going through it and you really embody it. And 20 years later, it means something even more intense to you and you can really own it. Or you kind of like move away from it and you don't really feel it anymore. You know?
Yeah.
I think old songs are interesting that way.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny when you say that, cause I, this is probably off topic, but, every time I've seen The Who play live and they play My Generation at the end, it's taken on a new meaning because My Generation at the time they wrote the song was meant to be this firebrand anthem of youth. And now I see all these older people together saying, hey, people try to put us down talking about My Generation. And I think about the feeling that you get when you grow older and you can feel discarded and all that kind of stuff. And to see how a song, when a song has resonance and when a song, you know, hits truth in that way, it actually can not only retain its resonance, but it can find a new application.
Yeah, I mean, the human condition just keeps repeating and repeating. It's not like, you know, it's kind of crazy, actually.
I was reading something about you writing the song Carry On from your 2016 album Daybreaks, and you said you wrote it at your kitchen piano, which I was like, we have kitchen pianos? That's cool. But you said it was something that just sort of like fell out of you in like 10 minutes. Like this song just came and, you know, I think any songwriter has those moments where there's something that just sort of comes on you like a force. And those tend to be memorable moments.
And after all's been said and done, who said it best? Were you the one? Let's just forget, leave it behind, and carry on. If you should find the time to speak, then speak to me. I'd never keep you from your final destiny, so carry on.
Is that typical for you? Do your songs tend to come like blasting out, or is songwriting for you more of kind of a shaping and sculpting longer process?
I think some songs, like that song, Come Away With Me, What Am I to You? Those are the songs that just came out. And a lot of songs start that way, but need sculpting after, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like on the new record, there was a lot of starts to songs that really felt like, okay, this is going to be cool, but they didn't have finished verses or final chords on certain sections. So I think for me, honestly, there has to be part of it that does just fall out and is inspired. That's the inspired magic of it. Even if it's just a title and just one melody.
Yeah.
Most of the songs on the new record are like that. A lot of the songs came with really inspired idea. And then we finished it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you've mentioned certain songs and you said, well, I wrote this one on guitar, I wrote that one on piano. And it's interesting because when I listen to your music, there's nothing that I could do and say, oh, that sounds like a song that was written on guitar. That sounds like it was written on piano. But there must be something, I mean, for me, I know that when I pick up a different instrument, it unlocks something different. And in fact, a different guitar will unlock something from another guitar. It doesn't have to be a different tuning. It can just simply be the feel of that particular instrument in my hands. I'm curious for you, you know, it sounds like you're not over analytical when it comes to looking at your own process, but if there is any thought process in your mind in terms of what the guitar brings out of you versus what the piano brings out of you.
Actually, I have thought about it, and I really think that playing the guitar when I moved to New York and not having a piano is why I started writing songs. Because I think in the beginning, in high school, I wrote this song on piano. I mean, it's a fine song for a 16-year-old. It's not like it was horrible, horrible, but I think what I didn't like about it was the sort of corny quality about it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about the piano, if you're not playing the right voicings and the recording is not just right, where the piano can make things sound a certain way. And that's not the way I wanted it to sound.
Yeah.
And so when I got to New York and I was strumming on a guitar, I was like, oh, I can play simple chords on the guitar and it doesn't sound corny. If I play like a triad on the piano, it sounds corny. If I play a seventh chord on the piano and all these cool voicings I learned in jazz school, it sounds like a jazz song, and that's not what I was trying to do, you know? And I think it's about stripping it back to the emotion. Once again, having such limited skills on the guitar enabled me to write a song that was really just pure emotion and not very complicated at all. And over the years, it's taken me a long time, but I finally come to the place, and Carry On is actually the perfect example of a song I did write on piano that is finally simple, but piano-y in a way that I like. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Absolutely. You've mentioned that song that you wrote when you were 16 that embarrassed you so much. Do you want to tell us the title of it?
What was the title? Will I Ever Love?
All right. I'm sold.
Wow, at 16, you were so jaded.
Will I ever love? I wanted to be in love, I think. It's funny because it was kind of a sad song, and my teacher said, when he heard it, he was like, Nora, I like the song. Are you okay?
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, looking back at the new record, one of the things that I often think about is, will I ever get a chance to write my Give Peace a Chance? And by that, I mean a song that, you know, I know they have those kind of like rapid fire lyric thing that he does at a certain point. But for the most part, that song is all we are saying is give peace a chance. What is that? Mm-hmm. 8 words or however many words it is. Such incredible economy, right? And I'm listening last night and I'm listening to I Just Want to Dance. I'm like, I think Nora just did it. I think she just did it. She just wrote her Give Peace a Chance. And what's interesting about that is I don't know if John was thinking about this, but all we are saying is give peace a chance. And he limits it to that phrase. Similarly, yeah. I just want to dance. And if you wrap the phrase like that in a million words surrounding it, then you lose the I just want to dance factor. So the economy really works for that title and that concept.
It was funny because I had the idea for that song and I didn't quite have all the chords figured out. And we got in the room with Leon was engineering and we had his friend Homer Simwise, who's an incredible drummer. He came in and it was just me on Whirly singing and Homer on drums. And the recording is all live drums, Whirly and singing. We used all the live stuff that we got that day in the one take. And afterward, we're like, this is cool. The groove is great. And Leon said, you know, I mean, we'll probably add some extra lyrics, but like, this is a great start. I said, no, that's not, it's, I just want to dance. That's the whole point. I had this idea that like, that's it. I don't want to talk about it. I just want to dance.
Totally. That's great.
And I do change it once. I say, I don't want to laugh about it. I just want to dance. But really I just want to dance. There's really nothing else to say. And the funny part about that song is it's a slow song. It's not like a fast dance song.
Right.
True.
Right.
I don't want to talk about it. I just want to dance. Oh. I just want to dance. I just want to dance. Just wanna dance.
A song like I'm Awake, which I think is another highlight on the record, it's just got this kind of meditative feel, again, that just kind of draws you in, and you get into that kind of repetitive groove, and it just feels good. And obviously we're talking about songwriting, and there's a difference between a song and a record, but when a song and a record complement each other, you know, and they fit together where you almost can't tell the difference between them, if that makes sense, you know, that's when you know it's like it's working. And I think one of the things that's interesting is you're playing so many instruments on this record. I think it's mostly you and Leon just kind of doing it all. Is that right?
The bulk of it is, but that song is actually, we had a live band in the studio, which is on three songs. And it's Brian Blade on drums on that song. And that's Jesse Murphy on bass. And that's three songs. I think it's all upright bass when he's playing it, but it might be one electric. And then Homer Simewise on I Just Want to Dance. And then other than that, it's all Leon on drums and bass and some keyboard bass that I played, and me on piano and guitar.
Yeah.
And tons of harmonies.
Yeah.
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 But that one's Brian Blade on drums, which is such a great groove.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
Remember when I lost control? I lost my soul. I finally wake. There were times when I lost my mind, but now I'm fine.
Nora, we cannot thank you enough for your time and chatting with us today. The new record is Visions. We encourage everyone to listen to it ASAP. Your entire body of work, from your own releases to your various side projects, is always exciting and engaging, and it's truly a thrill and an honor for us to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, guys. Have a great day.
Wow, what a fun interview.
Honestly, one of my favorites.
Yeah, very cool. So I don't know if everyone's been listening to Songcraft for a while, but there was a period where we kind of had a theme song.
Yeah.
And when the show would start, you'd hear this thing that went boom,
Just like that.
Yeah. Except not with my mouth. It was an actual recording. And that came from a song that I wrote and recorded called Soon As You Get Home. And it was kind of my attempt at writing like a smooth jam.
Yeah.
And the chorus of that song said, I'm going to light some candles, unplug the phone, put that Nora Jones record on, pour you a glass of burgundy wine. Yeah. You know where this is going. So anyway, I just thought that was kind of a fun little fact that the actual lyrics to that song that we used to use referenced, Nora Jones. Even funnier, Nora Jones, came to, Amoeba, when she was promoting her second album, and you could go and like buy the record and stand in line, and Nora would sign, you know, the record for you. So my wife and I went, we stood in line. I gave Nora a CD of that song. I was like, hey, I wrote this song. I was like, I'm not trying to pitch you this song.
Right.
It just name checks you. And yeah. I thought you'd get a kick out of it, which was looking back.
Security.
Yeah. It's like someone remove. I think the fact that my wife was with me was the only thing that kept me from being carted out of Amoeba. but anyway, kind of a fun little connection there to our old theme song and our new best friend, Nora Jones. if you haven't listened to a ton of Songcraft before, you're just kind of learning about us, you can find our website at songcraftshow.com. You can sign up for our email list there to find out every time we release a new episode, and it's a good way to stay in touch if you lean a little more toward the old school.
Yeah. We are also on social media.
Ooh.
Did you know that, Scott?
I did.
We're on Instagram.
Yep.
We're on Facebook. We will be on TikTok right around the time it stops being cool. we're not there yet, but stay tuned. Another thing, you know, if you actually want to go beyond just listening and actually be a part of supporting what Songcraft is doing, we're on Patreon as well.
That's right.
And so you can go to patreon.com/songcraftshow and see all the tiers we have, the rewards and everything. But that's a way that you can actually sort of be a part of supporting what we're doing going forward and really join the family in a sense.
Yeah, be a part of the Songcraft team. So check us out on Patreon. If you're on Instagram, you can find us at Songcraft Conversations. Facebook, you can find us at Songcraft Show. And again, the website is songcraftshow.com, or just send us an email, songcraft@songcraftshow.com. We would love to hear from you. Pick your favorite way of connecting. I don't think I mentioned our MySpace page. Is that still up?
Yeah, the MySpace, but nobody here is going to be in our top eight, so it's not even worth mentioning.
Well, with that, we're going to do a little spotlight piece on a young, new, fantastic songwriter named Tish Melton.
Yeah, a little bonus content.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, cool. We're just like, the hits keep coming, guys. Like, now we're having two people on an episode. This is very cool. So we're going to, we got to meet Tish recently. We want you guys to meet her too. We think she's a very talented young writer. And here we go. Tish, welcome to Songcraft.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to speak with you. We don't often get the chance to have 18-year-old singer-songwriters who have just released their first EP, so it's really fun to talk with somebody who's just kind of getting on the path and, you know, writing some of your early songs. And tell us a little bit about how you first got into writing songs, and maybe give us an example of one of your first one or two songs where you kind of thought, oh, I think maybe I kind of know how to do this.
Well, I started playing guitar over quarantine. I just had nothing to do, and so I was losing my mind, and my mom put a guitar in my hand and told me that she had signed me up for lessons, and it was not up for debate whether or not I wanted to do it. I just had to do it. So I like to say that the beginning of my music career was kind of against my will. Went in for lessons like once a week and just ended up falling in love with playing guitar. And then I think about 3 months, 4 months after I started playing guitar, I just started writing. And it was kind of just for fun. I don't really think I shared any of my music with anyone until like a long time after I started writing, because it just felt like the scariest thing in the world to do. But I remember my first song I wrote was called California. And it was horrible. I like think about the lyrics now and I'm like, that is the worst song I've ever written. But I remember I played, I honestly think the first song that I actually thought was good was The Chase, that's like on the EP. That was the first time where I like had a vision for how I wanted a song to be produced, which kind of made me think like, oh, this song is more than just what I'm writing right now. Like it has kind of a future where I think I could put it out and be proud of it for a while. So I think that that was that's the first song that I wrote for the EP. And I think one of the first songs that I like made me think that I could be a songwriter.
Wow. You know, when I hear The Chase, I hear elements of bands like Silver Sun Pickups or Manchester Orchestra, even a little like Boy Genius in there. Like, what are the things that you listen to that make you want to go and write a song? You know, sometimes we listen to stuff just for fun, it's in the background, but then you listen to something, you're like, I'm going to go pick up my guitar and write a song right now.
The first time, I remember so vividly listening to Lucy Dacus's home video. That album and like directly at like that album informed like my music so much, just in like the way that she songwrites, I think is so like it resonates so much with me and is so honest and simple. And so getting into her kind of got me into Phoebe and their Boy Genius, that whole band. So they're definitely one of my huge influences. I'm just like the biggest fan of them. So after listening to Lucy Dacus's home video, I think that was like the first time I ever shared a song with someone that I wrote. Like, oh, wow. I would sit my family down every month and just force myself to play them 5 songs that I'd written that month. And even if they were horrible, like I could just tell which ones that they liked better. So like playing to other people is like so important because I can tell which of my songs like resonate with people. And just by the way, like whether I'm keeping their attention or not, it's like even with just my family, that helped me a lot kind of figure out which direction I wanted to go with the rest of my songs. So
Yeah.
I would say my biggest songwriting inspiration is for sure Lucy Dacus.
Now, your path to your first EP has got some pretty wild names in it. I'm thinking the name of a legendary venue, the Troubadour. I'm thinking of Linda Perry. I'm thinking of Brandi Carlile. This is some serious heavy hitter kind of stuff. Tell us how all of that came together and those dots connected and led to your first EP.
Yeah, it was kind of like a. I mean, it all started when my best friends, like, I had just started playing my music for people, and my best friends for my, I think it was my 15th birthday, they booked me like 2 hours of studio time with a local producer. And I remember I played him The Chase. Like, I wrote that song so long ago, and I played him The Chase. And he had emailed us a couple days after those 2 hours, and we recorded just a little demo of it, an acoustic demo. And he was like, "You have something here. I think you're a good songwriter. I would like to work with you." And so I met with him a couple times, and I just got like the weirdest vibes. And he was giving me budgets that were so high, and we're like, "This just doesn't feel right." And my mom had been connected to Brandy through her writing, and she's like, "I'm just gonna ask this person who I'm not too close with what she thinks about this guy." And she immediately like flagged it down and was like, "That's weird. Let me direct you towards someone who I think could help you more." And I don't think at this point she had really even heard any of my music. We had worked together for a song for my mom's podcast when I was like in 9th grade, but other than that, we didn't really have much contact. And so she, Brandy, directed me towards Linda Perry, who I met with a couple times. I played her some of my songs. She thought that I needed more experience playing live, so she put me on the stage at her Equalizer foundation like fundraiser at the Troubadour. So my first show I ever played was at the Troubadour,
Wow.
which was quite unusual. I do recognize that. And so I played like a 20-minute set for Linda at the Troubadour, and then Linda sent a video of my set to Brandy, who then was like, "All right, like, there's something there. Send me some of your songs." And I sent her about 20 songs that I had written, and we chose five to record and went in the studio.
Wow. Wow.
I mean that team of people that are in your corner, it's like the Avengers, you know? I mean these are amazing names, amazing writers and amazing champions for you. But what I also know about them is that they're serious about their craft. Linda Perry's very honest, with her feelings and her thoughts about everything. So I imagine in one sense, yeah, you got these strong champions that are, helping to propel you forward. But at the same time, I'm sure they're pretty honest about what you need to do, how you can get better, all that kind of stuff. How are they speaking into your life as a writer and an artist?
I mean, I was terrified. I remember Brandy, when she directed us towards Linda initially, she was like, "I just have to tell you, like, she's going to be honest with you." And so I went to Linda's house and we talked for a bit. And then she's like, "Can you just play me a couple of your songs?" And I was terrified because one thing I remember was how honest she was. And I think I played her Michelle. And I remember her just being like, "Good song." And that was it. And I was like, "Oh my God, thank God." Like, it could have been so much, like, I was like, I feel like that was the best reaction I could have gotten from her. And I was so happy with that. But honestly, I think that most of my connection with music has come through Brandy, obviously, just because she's like the producer. And honestly, she's very honest with me. And I don't think we had much like tension in the studio over certain decisions. We were kind of on the same page from the beginning. So there wasn't much of her having to be like honest with me because she didn't like something. I think we were just very, like, we just gelled from the moment we got in there. We were on the same page about the songs we wanted to do. And then before we started even tracking a song, we would just sit down, just Brandy and me on the couch, and just start like play through the entire thing together and make sure we were on the same page. So I think there was like a lot of musical chemistry between us from the beginning. So even though I know Linda and Brandy are super honest and will tell me if they don't like something, I think I was lucky enough for them to like what I was doing already,
Yeah.
which
Yeah.
I feel so lucky.
Yeah, that's great. You mentioned playing Michelle, and that was the first single off the EP. Tell us a bit about that song and the inspiration for it and how it came together for you.
Yeah, I wrote that song, I think it was my sophomore year of high school, and I'm a senior now. And so I wrote it. I wasn't ever expecting to share it with anyone, but two of my best friends were having just like friendship problems, and I was really on the side of Michelle. And so I was trying to write a song from the other person's perspective to try to better understand her, because they were kind of just in this in-between where one person was just giving so much and expecting Michelle to reciprocate it, even though it wasn't really her job. So you kind of find yourself feeling bad for both the narrator and Michelle, and like there's no villain, or like it's all like so subjective, which I think is true of a lot of female friendships. So I wrote that from the other girl's perspective, just trying to better understand her. And then I just ended up really liking it because I think it was really relatable and honest. And we were supposed to come out with The Chase first. And then like 2 weeks before The Chase was supposed to come out, Brandy called me and was like, it's not The Chase. It has to be Michelle. Like, it's just honest and so true to you.
Wow.
I think that that should be the first one to come out. So we just switched everything up and decided to put out Michelle first, which I think ended up being the right decision.
I didn't know I took up too much space, and all she needed was lazy Sunday mornings. But I thought she'd think that I was boring, conforming. So I brought her Saturday night all the time. She met a new boy last night. Michelle told me.
Did you actually play the song for your friends, like at the time that it was all like going wild?
No, they don't know. Like all of the names are made up. So yeah. Just don't not aware of it. I mean, I think if they're like self-aware enough, they would try to realize it was about them, but I haven't heard anything from them, so.
Nice. I mean, that even that right there is that's a perspective I love when songwriters take that, you know, to make their lyrics a bit opaque. You know, mm-hmm. You can sort of see what's going on here, but it's not just so. It's a little impressionistic, I guess I would say. You know,
yeah.
I look at the lyrics of Damage, and I see, you know, I'm trying to look at it and say, are we feeling connected and positive to this person? Are we feeling that this person's going to damage us? You know, like I feel both the apprehension and the acceptance in love, which is, you know, it's a really cool way to approach a lyric. There's so much depth and so many ways to turn it and look at it. Are you someone, when you write, do you have lyrics that are in search of a melody usually, or are you a melody in search of a lyric? You know, how do you tend to approach these songs?
I would say like 90% of the time it's lyrics first, like in search of a melody. I like just find myself all the time just writing down like one-liners in my notes app, and then eventually go to my room and sit down and just go through all of them and see if there's anything in any of that. So I'm definitely very lyric centered, but then when I'm in right after I got out of the studio, I was like so inspired by like the band and like the production and that whole process that I like started kind of thinking oppositely. And I was like, how do I want, like, I want a song that sounds like this. And then like the lyrics come later. So I think it depends like what phase I'm at in like whether I'm recording or I haven't been recording for a while. Cause then I kind of switch back into that songwriter mindset. So I think it really depends.
Yeah. It's interesting. Earlier you said The Chase was like one of the first songs that you wrote where you could kind of like hear the production in your mind, like you could sort of imagine what you want the record to sound like, which is interesting because, you know, we talk to a lot of writers and some of them, they sit down with a piano or an acoustic guitar and they write the song and they're kind of just a blank slate in terms of how that gets produced. And others have like kind of concrete ideas about, you know, how they want this to sound in the studio. And they're almost kind of starting to produce the record in their head as they are writing the song. Now that you've been in the studio with somebody like Brandy and been playing with her musicians who are all fantastic, Has that impacted your writing in terms of now that you know what's possible? Have you started writing in a different way where you are kind of thinking about production during the writing process more now?
Yeah, I think so. I like went into the studio like having literally no expectations because I wasn't even at this point, I wasn't really close with Brandy. We hadn't talked that often. I didn't know her circle and the people that she brings into play, like band wise. And so I didn't know what was possible, like production wise either. So I really, the only songs that I had like kind of a clear vision for how I wanted it to sound was Sober and The Chase. And the rest of them, it felt like a completely blank slate to me. Like I kind of was just trusting Brandy's judgment, which ended up working out well. But I don't think I write any different now after coming out of the studio. I just think that I have a clearer vision of how I want the songs to sound. And it took me a while to start writing again because I felt like I would never write anything good again after I recorded those songs. But recently I started getting back into it and getting more confident again. So, but like also I think a big aspect of it now that I have been in the studio is how I want it to sound production wise.
One of the really interesting things to me about all this is that you seem to be writing solo, and just sort of came up with your own instincts. And we talk to so many people that co-write, and that's often part of a sort of a developmental stage of writing. But for you, you've come out with these instincts right away, which is sort of like, it's amazing. And it also keeps, you know, your fingerprint, you know, directly on the songs. Is that, you know, do you find yourself loving the fact that you're able to keep, you know, creativity kind of contained to yourself? Or are you kind of like, man, well, I'd also love to write with that person, or I'd love to write with this person, see what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, writing with just by myself is all I've ever known. So it's definitely where I'm most comfortable. But yeah, it's really developmental type thing to start co-writing. And I'm very open to it. Like, I really want to. I think it would be one of the scariest things I've ever done. Because like, I don't know. I think that my songs are so personal to me that I still haven't quite like understood how I wouldn't lose some of that like personal aspect of it by introducing someone else's feelings and like brain into my songs. So I think it'll be an interesting thing to do, but I definitely want to start doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul mentioned the song Damage earlier and the lyrics to that song. And I understand that you actually recorded it when you were not feeling well and you guys decided to just keep it the way it was. Talk about that creative decision.
Yeah, I think like when I started recording, I had to abandon so much of like the perfectionism that I've like created. Like just I've been in school for so long and like I go to like a really competitive private school and I've like created this perfectionism in my brain about my grades and like just like a lot of the things that I do, and I've been able to kind of sustain it because it like my grades can be perfect if I want them to be. But I had to understand when I got into the studio that like my music or my voice or like all of that just can't be perfect because that's just no such thing. And so I had gone to Santa Barbara a couple days before recording and like caught some kind of cold. I don't know where it came from, but I came in and my voice was completely shot. And so all of the takes on the first day and like throughout the week at Brandy's studio were supposed to be just like scratch takes until we could figure out something like a better vocal thing to do. But then like Damage specifically, that song is like so fragile and emotional that like the fragility and vulnerability of my voice just sounded so good in that specific song. And also like what I deem to be imperfect in my voice like does not sound that bad to other people. Like it doesn't sound that bad, but like to me it was the end of the world. But I've worked on that perfectionism. But keeping those takes, it definitely shifted my perspective on like songwriting and being a musician as a whole, because I don't know, just like nothing can be perfect, and something that I might be that might seem imperfect to me might be perfect for that specific scenario.
Dance around the kitchen, talk too loud, say anything and I'd listen, take it all or take it with a grain of salt, take me for granted, I've planned it, I'm equipped to handle your damage.
Thank you. Well, Tish, we want to encourage everybody to check out the EP When We're Older. Congratulations on everything that's happening and on starting this path with your first EP. It's really exciting, and you're a great writer. So keep doing it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Songcraft, please take a moment right now to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can keep up with us on Instagram at Songcraft Conversations or Facebook at Songcraft Show. To join our team and help support our content, become a Songcraft patron at patreon.com. Visit patreon.com/songcraftshow.
And you can always find us at songcraftshow.com.